Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
Owl Post for the week is freshly delivered, and I'm just so excited to be here as always. And with me, as always, is the just fantastically wonderful and brilliant Drea Kaufman.
Hello.
Gosh, as we're recording this, we're getting so close to Christmas 2018. I don't know about you, but I am ready to, you know, just enjoy the time off.
Eat some cookies and drink some cocoa and sunbathe under the palm trees. I mean,
yeah.
Oh, that's just here?
Yeah. So I've been already drinking a lot of cocoa. I've had cocoa 3 or 4 nights in a row now, just because for some reason it sounded really good. And as for where I live, it's been very chilly. Yeah, super excited. But I love, you know, that we're talking about Harry Potter as always. And for some reason, to me too, Harry Potter always feels Christmassy. I don't know why. Like, there's something about Harry Potter that maybe it's because it feels Dickensian in some ways, you know?
I can see that.
Yeah. Especially I think of the first two movies, you know, you really got that feeling. Before we dive into our chapter, The Order of the Phoenix, which is also the name of the book, which I always love when we get to those chapters, which is chapter 5 of The Order of the Phoenix, you can find us all over the place. You know, hit us up over on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Make sure you're subscribed so you get the episodes as soon as we drop them. Also, if you're over on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, help the show out. Give us a star rating, review, let people know what you think of the show. It really does help the show grow, and we really appreciate it. We've had so many people give us star ratings and reviews. In fact, out of 89 ratings, Drea, we have an average of 5 stars. So that's pretty awesome.
Yay.
Yeah. So thank you, everybody. And, you know, don't forget about finding us over on Twitter at Join Nerd Party. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/nerdparty. We've got the website, thenerdparty.com. And maybe you wanted to send us an email because we love getting emails and we don't get enough of them. So go over to thenerdparty.com/contact, choose a show, choose Outpost, and then that email comes to Drea and I. So diving into this one, I think it's interesting because we pick immediately up where we left off, which is Harry just finding out from Sirius that this is his house, which I think is really interesting in how that this was his parents' house and this is where he grew up and that he's offered it to Dumbledore as the headquarters for the aforementioned Order of the Phoenix.
I love how he kind of bitterly adds, because it's the only thing he can do for the Order. And I like that Harry feels like it sort of makes him feel familiar, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he's also not really allowed to do anything.
Right.
And so it's nice to see that he's not the only one sort of not doing something. So,
well, no, absolutely. I was thinking that this whole entire chapter and the next chapter, honestly, will continue this theme of this fact of Sirius and Harry kind of being in very similar places and feeling very similarly in the fact that they are out of the fight, really, you know, and they're not being given enough to do. And it's really frustrating them. And it's causing, I would say, for both of them, kind of a severe depression.
Put me in, coach. Put me in.
Pretty much. I know I can do it. And I love, you know, as they go into the kitchen, and Miss Weasley's getting all up in people's grills because they haven't put away, you know, the different maps that they've got out and the conversations that are happening. And, you know, Bill and Mad-Eye are getting in trouble. And so is Tonks for, you know, leaving things out. And, you know, she's talking about how they should have it all cleaned up by the time people are coming in and everything. And it's just, you can tell that there's been some serious conversations happening from the last chapter when they were having this meeting. And you just, I feel like there's all this anticipation that's building towards us being told something about what's going on, the same way Harry's got to be feeling that.
Yeah, and I feel like we're seeing a bit of an amplified version of Mrs. Weasley, right? Molly's always been a little high strung and a little mother hen like, but this chapter, I think it really hits sort of max mom mode, right? Max overprotective mother. Cause she's getting nitpicky about people leaving stuff out and, you know, all those things. And, we really see it start to kind of explode in this chapter, in the same way that Harry sort of exploded in the last chapter. You know, he exploded from anger. She's sort of exploding with momness. So it just kind of goes to show like tensions are high across the board. And when that happens, I feel like all the different little things that define your personality become very amplified and people don't have patience for them anymore. So it's very good of most of the members of the order to be pretty patient and understanding with her. But tensions are, you can just tell, like, without anything else, the tensions are very, very high just based on her sort of overreaction to everything.
Yeah, I think you have a really good point. You know, she has this, I think of it as kind of that mom fear. You know, where she is fearful for her children, what's going on in the world, and that feeling of almost kind of a helplessness, that the only thing she feels like she can do is try to overprotect them. And that may or may not actually be what's best for them. And I think this chapter really kind of plays out that tension, because not everybody agrees with Molly about how she should be dealing with these, either, you know, like Fred and George, who are actually of age now in the wizarding world, and adults, considered adults, and, you know, Ron, Harry, and Hermione, who are pretty much at the center of everything that's happened for the last 4 years with, you know, Voldemort and all of these kind of things. So I think she's having a very tough time dealing with that, and her goal is to push them as far away from it as possible. And yet, again, not everybody agrees with her assessment exactly on how they should be dealt with. And like you said, it's creating a lot of tension there. At the same time, as, you know, people are also trying to kind of, I think, cut her some slack as well.
Yeah. Well, and when you have the tendency to be controlling, or you don't deal well with things being out of your control, you generally snap and try to control that, which you can.
Yes. Right?
So she can control how clean the house is. She can control whether her kids are included in these conversations. She can control handling meal times and stuff like that, you know, where she can't control the chaos that's happening outside. And the more she can't control what happens in the world, the more she wants to control the things at home. So I feel like that's also a very common trait that people can relate to. You know, we always talk about how relatable and human these books are. I think that's another one, another trait that's very relatable for a lot of people. So Molly Weasley definitely becomes a more deep character starting with this chapter. You know, this is where we really get the deepening of that, and she's not just mom anymore. She's sort of got her own personality now, and we'll see even more of that in the upcoming chapters. But this chapter is really interesting, and it is interesting to hear that the wizarding world sees adults start at the age of 17, which is what Fred and George are, like you mentioned. So you know, when it comes time to, I love the part when they start talking about the fact that, you know, Sirius is actually the one who has sort of the ultimate say on what Harry can and can't do, because, you know, he's his godfather, and that was the whole point of picking a godparent. But I do love the moment when Molly says, like, yeah, I know he's not my son, but he might as well be. Like, he's as good as my boy. And I just love Harry, like, okay, so while he really wants to know what's going on, there was still a part of him that just loved the fact that Mrs. Weasley thought he was her son. You know, like, he loved that feeling for that moment. But he more wanted to know what was going on, and he wanted to get the scoop. Again, it speaks to how angry he is that he considered not telling Ron and Hermione what was going on for like a split second. But I do love, I think my favorite part of this whole chapter, though, is when they send Ginny off. Ginny's the only one that we can't come up with a good excuse to let her stay in this very adult conversation we're about to have. And the book just paints it as like she just walks off like almost like an anime character. You can like see the steam coming out of her ears and her eyes turn to flames and her mouth just turns upside down and is so angry. Like she just storms off in like a fit of rage. And, you know, I just find that so funny that she's already such a little spitfire and we don't get much of her. So all of a sudden for her to just be so angry and vocal about it was pretty wonderful. It was pretty wonderful. I'd probably do the same if I were her. So it's probably just why I like it so much.
Well, and I mean, when you think about it, she is only a year younger than Ron, Harry, and Hermione. So it's not like this is all that crazy. And so, you know, she really is, she's right at that age. And so one of the things I thought was really funny about this chapter is there's a juxtaposition between some funny moments, and then you've got some moments of kind of like depressive moments, and then you've got information moments. And I love that Tonks is kind of always in the middle of all the funny moments, like when she's trying to help Molly with the cooking and Molly's like, oh, no. Got it. And like Tonks is already tripping over things to help out and everything, which is, I think, great. You've got, you know, McDungus causing trouble with Molly too by smoking in the kitchen, which he's already upset about. And we actually kind of, what I thought was great, we kind of learn why in the world they have McDungus around in the first place is because Dumbledore had saved his life at one point. And then he's loyal to Dumbledore now. And it's also great because, yeah, he's a criminal, but he has access to a whole side of the Wizarding universe that none of the other people do. And he hears things, he talks to people that nobody else does. So it makes for a great spy. But I love, as we were kind of talking about at the beginning, there's this whole mood between Harry and Sirius of being kind of depressed and, you know, he asks Harry about how his summer's been going, and he's like, it's been lousy. And he's like, I don't know what you're complaining about. And he's like, what? He's like, I would have loved a Dementor attack. Sirius is like, I would have loved to have been in some action. He's like, I haven't been able to do anything. I can't do anything. He's like, the ministry thinks I'm still a murderer. And they also have, you know, Voldemort would know about my animagus now because of Wormtail. So I'm pretty much useless except for this dingy, dirty, nasty house that I grew up in that, you know, we get to use as the Order of the Phoenix. Is like, you just feel pretty bad about it. And then on top of it, to just rub in the salt, he's like, oh yeah, it's so great to listen to Snape talking about all of his, you know, out there risking his life and everything, and I'm here cleaning. Like, he is pretty bitter.
We also learn in this chapter that, you know, we learned in the last chapter that Harry is sort of the butt of a lot of jokes and they're trying to discredit him in the Daily Prophet. We talked a little bit about the power of media. And then in this chapter, we learn it's even stronger. What's happening to Dumbledore is not only are they trying to tarnish his sort of public credibility, but they've actually removed him from the Wizarding Council. And they're talking about removing like his Order of Merlin designation and all this stuff, which is a big deal. He's basically being stripped of all of his official powers and titles and authorities, in an attempt to sort of downplay his ability to sway the population. So I do like, though, that Bill adds a bit of comedy to it and mentions like, oh, he doesn't care as long as they don't take it off his, as long as they don't take away his chocolate frog card, right. You know, which we know is mostly based on him defeating Grindelwald. So we're pretty sure that's not going to happen. But I do appreciate the fact that she's trying to paint the severity of what is happening right now, which is adding to sort of the heightened tensions and that the ministry is very much so not on their side anymore, and they have to be very, very careful. So, yeah, it's a pretty chock-filled chapter, and the ultimate showdown between Molly and Sirius is pretty epic. I mean, they really go at each other, no holds bar, about whether they should be telling the kids about what's going on and to what extent, and it's, you know, it's hard to weigh in and decide which way you kind of feel like it should go, because as a reader, you want to know and you want Harry to know. But then you start thinking about it, is it really prudent to be telling them, or, you know, where's that line? So it's really an interesting kind of self-debate you get to have here too, about what you feel like is appropriate and what you don't feel like is appropriate. Because I'm sure there's some readers out there who were like, no, I'm totally with Molly. And others were like, no, we're with Sirius. So, I mean, I think there were valid arguments on both sides. So,
you know, I think the thing that's interesting too is that Molly kind of comes at this in a way that is almost below the belt, you know, where she's talking about how, you know, oh, you just think you have James back, you know, and it's like you have your best friend back. And what's interesting is that between these two extremes is that I really appreciate Mr. Weasley and I really appreciate Lupin coming in and kind of, and I love that Mr. Weasley, when he talks, he doesn't talk immediately. He's like, he's sitting there, he's cleaning his glasses, he's being very deliberate, and he's saying, I think that we should tell them some things, that they have the right to know some of the things, not everything, but they do have the right to know some things. And I love that, you know, Lupin feels the same way. And I think I was thinking about what you were talking about, you know, the whole idea of like, which side is right. And I think that, you know, that middle is definitely where you come to, because, you know, in many ways too, this does revolve around Harry. You know, this whole thing is about him, really. And so it is, and as Lupin says, it's better for them to get the facts from us, the actual facts, than just kind of, you know, as he meant, you know, he alludes to the fact of the extendable ears and them hearing some bits and pieces and trying to put things together. It's better for them to be more informed. And I think the whole Harry Potter series is about that, of not placating children. You know, of not treating them as if they shouldn't know things,
we'll come to see. And so in this point in the book, it is strictly sort of painted as they don't want to tell them because they're children, right? And Molly's whole approach is like, let them be children. They are children. We don't need to burden them with this, right? We don't need to worry them or scare them. You know, and Harry and Hermione and Ron's points are that, you know, they've been an adult for a while now. They've seen and experienced many things beyond their childhood years, right? But we kind of are alluded to the fact that there could be more going on than we know, right? Especially based on her previous books and knowing that nothing is as straightforward as she sort of depicts it to be at first. You get the idea that there is a reason why they are not to tell them more than they need to know. And it's not because they're children, which I think we'll see play out about 2/3 of the way through this book. We'll definitely find out what that is, and it'll definitely pay off at the end. But yeah, we definitely get a little bit of an impression at this point that there's more than meets the eye as to why they shouldn't be told, and it's not just because they're children.
Well, I think that there was something that we talked about a few chapters ago, which is this idea of perspective, and it is hard to have a correct perspective if you don't have all of the information. And that is one thing that we are going to see later on, as you alluded to. A lot of things that happen in this book happen because people jump to conclusions based on the information they do have, but it's not complete information. And that jumping to conclusions leads to some things that may or may not be good. And so I think that they do make a really wise choice here, which is to tell the kids some things, because it is important for them to know, because knowing Ron, Harry, and Hermione, they're going to find out the information somehow, and it's better just to sit them down and tell them now than have them find out in a way that could actually really get them hurt. Or
others.
Right, others hurt. And I think, you know, at the same time, this is a really big question. I think Rowling's, I would think that if you had a conversation with her about parenting, she's probably more inclined to say, no, we should just tell kids things. You know, we shouldn't hide things from kids. We shouldn't treat them as, you know, children who can't handle stuff. You know, I mean, like when you look at, you know, the original Grimm's fairy tales, they're pretty grim on purpose, you know. And I think she's doing the same thing because, again, we've said many times this whole series is about death and dealing with death. And so that's not a subject you talk to kids about a lot. But Rowling does that throughout every single one of her books where we're kind of reminded of it constantly with Harry's parents and then other people that die. Like, you know, of course, the last book where we just saw Cedric die in front of Harry's eyes. You know, so we are reminded that it's a constant part of life, and yet so many times we try to hide it from our kids. And, you know, that's a fine line to walk, and they're having that argument here, and they finally start kind of opening up to the kids about what's going on. And I love how Harry kind of has a very black and white view of the universe, and as they start explaining, as you were mentioning earlier, that, you know, we've got the media against us, and we've got the government against us, and we've got perception against us because of what's happening between the media and the government about somebody like Dumbledore and you. Therefore, we are having a really hard time doing what we want to be doing, which is to recruit followers to our side and convince people that Voldemort is actually back. And the reason that this is the case is not just that they are, you know, horrible editorials and damning editorials of Dumbledore and, you know, Harry Potter in the news, but it's coming from the very top, which is the fact that you've got Fudge, who is so fearful that if Voldemort is truly back, it would upend his power. And he's worried about, he thinks, Dumbledore trying to take it over, even though we learn in this chapter that Dumbledore has been offered power in the ministry and has never taken it. He's only helped those who have been in power, like when Cornelius first became the minister for magic. He would go to Dumbledore all the time and ask questions.
Yeah, it just weighs in on that character, and we get to learn more and more about this sort of... I always think of him as this like kind of mysterious backstory of Dumbledore that we don't really understand why he makes the decisions he does and why he's become the person he has, because he's sort of very quiet on that front. And this is, again, just one of those decisions that people would question, right? Like, you don't want power. Okay, that's something most people find desirable, like wealth, you know, or status. And he doesn't clearly care about really any of those at this point, from what we've seen. So it just kind of leaves you with this question of who Dumbledore is and what his motivations are. And not in a bad way, but, you know, we all have things that motivate us. And it's usually money, power, wealth, or family. And we know that Dumbledore doesn't really have any of those four. So really looking for that motivator and essence of who he is. These are just tiny little snippets that we're learning about him that makes us question sort of the man we know and what makes him tick. It's just a tiny little aside in the chapter, but it really adds quite a bit of depth to the story and to the character. So it's a nice little call out there that I had forgotten about.
Well, and I really like the way that we see this collusion between the government and the media to create a false narrative. To create a narrative that they want to have propagated, and that narrative, repeated so many times, people are believing it. You know, and you mentioned, I think, last week, which I thought was brilliant, about reminding us that Molly had even kind of fallen for that a little bit. And so that nobody is above hearing something so many times and just starting to believe it as fact and truth. And so that's the problem that we're getting is this, you know, deep-seated collusion between these two to create a narrative that's completely false, that isn't putting the entire, not just wizarding world, but the literal entire world at risk. It's like, and I think the brilliance of what she's doing here is that She is hearkening back to so many things throughout history, and she's reminding us of how these things happen. You know, how evil comes to power is because good people do nothing and or pretend like it's not even happening. So we really do have Fudge, I think, very much falling into the role of the classic Neville Chamberlain type thing, which is to appease and to pretend like something doesn't exist so that, you know, everything will just stay the same, you know, and just hold the line. It's going to be fine. Don't worry about it. Nothing's wrong. No, look at the man behind the curtain kind of thing. And it turns out to be a mess. But the other thing that I thought was fascinating is we learned how important Harry was to this, and the fact that he immediately going to Dumbledore right after Voldemort's return changed everything. In fact, Harry surviving has changed everything, because Voldemort was not expecting anybody to survive and let anybody know that he had been back. And therefore, Harry has already had a huge influence. And not only that, but we finally learn here in this chapter, Voldemort is afraid of Dumbledore, which I think is incredible to hear that he's afraid of anything at this point. That's, I think that is a really cool little piece that she adds in this chapter.
I do. I agree. And I like that we get, she's trying to teach these kids the impact of their actions, right? Like the small action of Harry going to Dumbledore had a significant impact that he didn't even know. So just showing how the little things weigh in on these bigger decisions. It's hard for us to see how our choices affect what's going on around us sometimes. And I think she's really trying to drive that point home, that what we do has an effect in actions beyond ourselves. With things like that as well. And it goes to show how all the little choices going forward mean more than the choice we make, right? Harry chose to tell Dumbledore because he thought it was important and he knew he could trust Dumbledore. And that's the most authority figure he could kind of feel comfortable with. And others read that as so much more than what it is, right? So I think it's also a testament to not only how big your choices are, but to treading lightly and understanding, thinking about the different ways that they could kind of be read or misunderstood. Because we come to find that a lot of what Harry and Dumbledore have done the last few years are really being judged heavily by others as having ulterior motives and not being what they appear to be. So it's kind of the opening door to a lot of what's going to happen in this book and going forward.
I think it's really fascinating too that we also get a little bit of a taste of what's been happening. So the fact that they are working very hard to convince people Voldemort is back, which is difficult because they also know that Voldemort is doing the same thing, because he's been thrown for a loop, as we just mentioned, because he wasn't expecting anybody to know him, have him back. But they're worried about, you know, the giants going to his side, evil creatures going to his side. And they're kind of in, and I would say it's interesting to say this phrase, because the weather outside in the book has been so heated. It's been a very hot summer there. Everybody's hot and sweaty and frustrated, and we're really at a boiling point. But what's come of where we are in this Wizarding World war is a cold war, where both sides are kind of working behind the scenes to do things. And we got a taste of the way that Voldemort works on getting followers, and it's by tricks and jinx and blackmails and all of those kind of things. Like, he doesn't do anything in the open. He has all of these operations and these fingers and all of these pies so that he doesn't get caught. And we also get a look at the fact that he may be after something he didn't have the last time, which is some kind of weapon. And that's pretty much where everything gets cut off. Molly puts her foot down and says, "No more. We are not talking about this anymore." And Harry's like, but I want to join the fight. And I absolutely love that Lupin says no. He's the one who says no. He says, look, the order is comprised of overage wizards who have left school, and there are dangers to which none of you have any idea of. And Molly's right. We've had enough. And I really think that it's very interesting to watch all of these adults struggle with this world that is at war and how to deal with their kids who have already been a big part of it, and how to move forward. And it's not easy, especially when one of the kids specifically is kind of at the center of it.
Without making him feel like he's at the center of it, right? Like, he's had all this firsthand experience, but he still can't quite understand why him, why what makes him special, and we haven't really found that out either. Why Harry? Why does he seem to be the key and the turning point? And we know, you know, he defeated Voldemort last time, but there's just, it still leaves so many questions, because, you know, we see, that's the next chapter. Yeah, it just still leaves all kinds of questions, because, you know, we know he's not alone in these battles and these losses. So it'll be really interesting. And I do love that, you know, Molly tells them to head straight up to bed after she kind of cuts them off. And they sort of recognize they've learned all they're going to learn, and they're going to head upstairs now. So that's kind of where we end the chapter, is at the end of this conversation, sort of defeated ourselves. And we get to pick up in the next chapter with the kids kind of processing through what that means and learning a little bit more of what the day-to-day life in the house is going to be like. So kind of a little bit of a lighter chapter in parts next, but left with some questions answered and then more questions on top of those questions. So.
Yeah, I think the thing that I really appreciated about this chapter is that, you know, we started this series with Harry, who is an orphan, and we have people basically fighting over who cares about him more, which is great. You know,
it is. It's really sweet.
And I think, you know, that shows you how far we've come. And as angry as Harry has been, you know, I think that connection that he has with Sirius and he has with the Weasley family are going to be something that are going to become more and more important to him as we move forward. And I think she's doing a really smart thing here, you know, because earlier and, you know, last week we talked about how, you know, Percy and the struggles of the Weasley family, you know, Molly even at the beginning here mentions Percy and then immediately moves to another subject at the beginning of this chapter. And we see the pain that family can cause. But here, I think we also see, you know, in this chapter, we see the beauty that family is, which is it's the thing that you hold on to when you're going through something like this. And so I appreciated that about this chapter, that there's a lot of nuance going on in this chapter of the struggles of what it means to be an adult, to try and raise children, to be a part of something like this in a resistance and a war against just pure evil, and find a way through all of that and still find some semblance of yourself is difficult. And I think it's a great chapter, and I can't wait to continue the book. We'll hit episode 100 next week. So, and which is actually the halfway point of our podcast.
I don't know if I should be excited or disappointed.
It just seems to have gone by so fast. So,
I know.
You know, it would be great, you know, if we'd love to get some messages from people, emails, hit us up on social media, hashtag Owlpost. Let us know, you know, your favorite Harry Potter things from all over the series. We'd love to have that kind of stuff. That would be great. But, Drea, if anybody wants to talk to you and reminisce about 99 episodes of Owlpost, where can they find you?
You want to tell me about your 99 problems, but a Harry Potter episode isn't one of them. You can find me on Twitter at PCFChick or on Instagram at Drea Kaufman, and it's C-O-F-F-M-A-N.
And you can find me, Matt Rushing 02, and I'm on on so many different social media platforms, Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Tumblr under that. So find me anywhere, MattRushing02. I'm here on the network doing aggressive negotiations with John Mills, talking about Star Wars each and every week. And then you can also find me on the Trek FM network doing two shows. I do The Orb, Chris Jones, talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and then I do the 602 Club, where we talk about all the fandoms we love. In fact, Dre and I just recently talked about The Crimes of Grindelwald, so check that out. And then, last but not least, I do a show called Cinema Stories with my friend Courtney, and that's where we talk about films, but through the lens of faith. But we want to say thank you so much for checking your Owl Post.
Mischief managed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.